economic state right now. Well, you only have to go out in the streets and some of the famous streets in London and look how many people are suffering and sleeping on the streets. And that is quite embarrassing and appalling for any sort of government, let alone a monarchy, to be proud to celebrate and spend that amount of money when people are suffering.
Why are many mainstream platforms? So what the royal family stand for today might be different, but it's very, very difficult to erase history. And they have to respect that a large portion of the public still connect them to, let's say, some incredibly sad, vicious and violent times.
The new monarch now faces many challenges, and they're not just including the social, economic and political crises which plague the nation, but also the deep divisions within his own family as well. Depending on how the king handles these many crises could heavily impact the fight for survival that the royal institution now finds itself in. Robert Carter, Windsor.
Showing absolutely no remorse. These are the confessions of the man that led the Harakat al-Nizal separatist group, responsible for several terrorist operations in Iran that left over 450 casualties in a span of 15 years.
According to our plan, our members received military training. That is because we wanted to give the impression that Harakat al-Nizal is strong and can carry out military operations. We even started our activities with an attack on the governor's office inside the city in a residential area.
Based on the theory that the end justifies the means, the Swedish-backed terrorist ringleader masterminded one of the deadliest terror attacks in Iran. In 2018, the attack on a military parade in the southwestern city of Ahvaz killed at least 25 people and injured 70 others, many of which were civilian onlookers.
You could say that all of those who were killed or injured in the attacks were ordinary civilians. We really didn't care. Even many of them were Arabs, and that was okay. We just wanted everyone to know about us. We want people to know Harakat al-Nizal.
The Harakat al-Nizal terror group has been pushing to separate the southwestern province of Khuzestan, which is home to Iran's Arab population.
Arab, Turk, or Persian. We are all Iranians and we will always remain united.
I took part in this funeral to show my support for the Islamic Republic and our leader Ayatollah Khamenei. We are one and nobody can divide us.
Today, I came here to send the message that we will always remain united.
Habib Farajullah Cha'ab, nicknamed Habib Osaivand, head of the terrorist group, was arrested in 2020. He stood trial in 2022, where he pleaded guilty and was convicted and sentenced to death. Iran's Supreme Court upheld the death sentence, and he was executed on May 6th. His mission remains a failed plot. Gisu Misha Ahmadi, Tehran.
A vigil was held in Gaza denouncing the latest Israeli crimes in Nablus, which led to the killing of three Palestinian men and a woman. Israeli occupation forces raided Nablus city on Thursday morning and assassinated three freedom fighters. Israeli army claims that the victims are responsible for the resistance operation in the Jordan Sea last month. People from all walks of life in the besieged Gaza city came out in solidarity with the West Bank against the Israeli regime's atrocities, confirming their utter support for the Palestinian resistance in the West Bank.
Those who were killed by the Israeli occupation were defending the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and killing them in cold blood is a war crime committed by the Zionist criminals. These crimes would only increase the Palestinian resistance actions and strengthen their unity against the occupation forces.
Al-Ghul insisted on the unity of the Palestinian resistance factions in Gaza and the West Bank.
We urge the Arin al-Usud resistance group and all freedom fighters to unite. We are with you from Gaza, the 1948 occupied lands, the West Bank, and even from outside Palestinian territories in Lebanon and Syria. We are all awaiting the leader Mohammed al-Daif's commands to start battle and free Palestine.
On a separate incident, the Israeli forces murdered a Palestinian woman in Huwara town in Nablus. The assassination raised the death toll of the Palestinians to at least 102, including 20 children so far in 2023. During the vigil, people chanted slogans in defiance of the Israeli occupation and called for retaliation.
The Palestinian resistance is much more experienced against the Israeli occupation. They started with nonviolent approaches and then raised the bar for the Zionist enemy due to its brutality against the Palestinians. The Palestinian resistance in the occupied West Bank learned lessons from what happened in Gaza and are now following their footsteps. The Israelis know that the resistance is now invincible. They are certain that the resistance is able to bring them down, especially when the Netanyahu cabinet faces serious challenges in the occupied lands.
Tensions have been escalating in the West Bank in the past months. The Israeli army has intensified its operations into the Palestinian cities and towns, during which they arrested and killed tens of Palestinians. The Israeli regime commits human rights violations and war crimes on a daily basis against the Palestinian people across all Palestinian territories. And with every crime, it knows that it becomes harder to restrain the Palestinian resistance actions. Ulal Asi, Gaza.
Millions of struggling homeowners with tracker mortgages across the 27-nation eurozone will soon start paying back even more following a decision by the European Central Bank to increase interest rates by a quarter of 1%.
We have covered a lot of ground in the last 9 months, right? Moving from minus 50 basis points to plus 300 basis points. We are continuing this hiking process.
Rents are going up as landlords with mortgages pass on the costs. The aim is to bring down inflation, but disgruntled unions insist the strategy won't work. It's all linked to energy sanctions against Russia. EU citizens are being financially pummeled. However, the bloc's leaders have just agreed on a huge additional package to arm Ukraine.
So we are talking about $1 billion capacity to upscale our industrial base.
Ordinary people don't see an end in sight to the crippling cost of living crisis.
A person who is employed, he can survive, but just think about a person who is not employed, how it is impacting him.
If we don't have also like kind of a push on the wages, we will not be able to cope with that, and our reserves, our savings will go down.
Analysts suggest peace in Ukraine is the answer, but EU authorities say Kiev will be supplied with deadly weapons for as long as it takes.
It is for Ukraine, that is the country that has been attacked, to decide in which conditions it is ready to find peace with Russia.
Employment ministers have been assessing pressures on EU businesses due to high inflation and interest rates. Firms are also struggling to find skilled workers.
26% of companies all over Europe consider that labour shortage are a major difficulty for them.
Because EU leaders have cut off cheap gas and oil flows from Russia, winter 2023 will tell us all we need to know about the bloc's resilience, or lack thereof. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Italy-France government relationship appears to be again in freefall after French Interior Minister Gérald Darmanin said on Thursday that the Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni is incapable of solving Italy's migrant crisis on which she was elected. The derogatory remarks, also reiterated by French Transport Minister Clément Beaune on Friday, have caused uproar in the Italian government. Prime Minister Meloni is said to be on the verge of cancelling a planned trip to Paris to meet French President Emmanuel Macron, while Italy's Foreign Minister Antonio Tajani has demanded Paris an apology for what he called gratuitous and vulgar insults towards a friendly and allied country.
This rift of immigration can be framed in a European context with Italy that has repeatedly demanded to improve the burden distribution across the EU. This umpteenth diplomatic spat between Rome and Paris takes place on the backdrop of a new humanitarian emergency in Sudan, which can greatly exacerbate the migrant crisis.
Rome and Paris have often been at loggerheads in recent years. The latest rift dates back to November last year, when a French NGO-run search and rescue vessel carrying more than 230 asylum seekers was refused a port of safety by Italy's government for around 3 weeks. On that occasion, in response to the situation, the French government suspended plans to take in 3,500 refugees who had landed in Italy, contravening the European Union's migrant relocation mechanism.
We firmly believe that Brussels must develop a coherent approach to distributing the migrants across the EU. About 94,000 migrants landed in Italy in 2022. You know how many migrants were relocated to France? 38. And to Germany, 57.
Later on Friday, Paris sought to play down the fresh row with Rome, saying that Italy is an essential partner to France and their relationship is founded on mutual respect. Meanwhile, migrant arrivals in Italy have more than tripled from last year. The country's recent centres are overcrowded and some have passed the breaking point. Max Civili, Rome.
Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi on Thursday wrapped up his two-day visit to Syria, where he met with his counterpart Bashar al-Assad. The visit was the first by an Iranian president to Syria since the Arab country was gripped by war in 2011. Raisi has called his Syria visit a turning point in bilateral ties.
This trip will be a turning point in Iran-Syria relations and will have an effect on the region and the trade and economic relations of the two countries.
The Iranian and Syrian governments have also issued a joint statement that highlights several points. The two sides have expressed strong determination to cement bilateral relations in different areas, particularly trade and economy. On Wednesday, the first day of his trip, the Iranian president signed a long-term comprehensive strategic cooperation agreement with his Syrian counterpart at the presidential palace in Damascus. Raisi said the long-term agreement will open a new chapter in cordial relations. 14 more documents were signed as well, all aiming to enhance bilateral cooperation. Iran, meanwhile, renewed its readiness to help Syria in its reconstruction efforts following the years-long conflict triggered by foreign-backed militancy. The pledge was made by President Raisi as he made a speech at the Holy Shrine of Hazrat Zainab, the granddaughter of Prophet Muhammad. Raisi also lashed out at the U.S. and Israel for backing terror groups in Syria.
For 12 years, the oppressed people hatched conspiracies and committed sedition, gave easy money to Daesh and Takfiri terrorist groups, used media empires to conduct psychological warfare, inflicted damage, destroyed homes, killed children, and made women homeless. For 12 years, the U.S., Israel, and the Takfiri Daesh terrorist groups they backed committed crimes in Syria. But Syria is standing strong today.
Combating terrorism is another issue Iran and Syria put focus on in their joint statement. They've pledged to continue to work together to fight terrorism and extremism until all terror groups are completely wiped out. The statement also denounces the U.S. military presence in Syria as well as its looting of the country's natural resources. It demands the international community to bring an end to the U.S. measures. The Iranian-Syrian statement also denounces Western sanctions imposed on both nations. Meanwhile, it slammed the Israeli regime for its repeated acts of aggression against Syria, saying that Damascus has the right to respond to Tel Aviv's aggression. The statement said that the Israeli aggression is a destabilizing factor in West Asia. Iran has said President Raisi's visit to Syria is in line with efforts to reinforce the axis of resistance in West Asia, including in the occupied territories, Lebanon and Syria itself. This should be seen against the backdrop of Israel's weakening position in the region, as the regime is gripped by turmoil inside and facing mounting resistance outside. Iran and Syria are both under Western economic sanctions. The restrictive measures, however, seem to be a blessing in disguise for both nations as they're resolute in overcoming economic hurdles by forming stronger bonds and relying on their own potentialities.
On Thursday, about 6,000 employees from the Italian phone carrier Wind Tre walked out of work in protest against the management's decision to spin off the firm's network assets into a separate company. Wind Tre is the third largest Italian mobile operator with about 20 million customers and the second largest fixed line operator with almost 3 million subscribers. The industrial action had been called by Italy's three largest trade unions, CGL, CISL and UIL, against the unbundling deal, which unions and workers say is the prelude to mass layoffs.
We have to stand united against this spin-off. Breaking up companies always leads to detrimental consequences for workers. The best case scenario is that we get further stripped of working rights. The worst is thousands of layoffs.
The spin-off of telecoms operator Wind Tre will pave the way for the sale of a majority stake in the grid company to Swedish private equity firm EQT. Unionists say Wind Tre will shift some 2,000 workers out of a total 6,500 workers in Italy into the network venture.
Sta cambiando il modello industriale.
The industrial system as a whole is shifting towards a new paradigm in the communication sector, which features separating the management of the network grid from that of services. This way, Italy will further lose control on its strategic assets, and many smaller companies will kick in, exacerbating job insecurity in the country.
Job insecurity is rampant in Italy. According to statistical agency Eurostat's figures, Italy has the second lowest employment rate for young workers in Europe, at about 30%. Also, Italy has no minimum wage, but protects workers through collective agreements, which often remains a dead letter for people on precarious contracts. Meanwhile, Italy's government has scrapped an anti-poverty benefit that goes under the name of citizen income, replacing it with a more limited inclusion check for qualifying households starting from January 2024. Prime Minister Meloni argues that the citizen income, which helped about 4 million people last year, costs too much and discourages people, especially youths, from looking for jobs.
Personally, I have been forever looking for a dignifying job, but the only things I'm offered are badly paid long-hour jobs. The citizen income should have been amended, but not scrapped altogether.
Nearly half of workers aged between 30 and 34 in Italy have an income between 8,000 and 16,000 euro a year, an income bracket that ranges from absolute poverty to near subsistence. An increasing number of Italians are leaving the country in search of better opportunities abroad. Max Civili, Rome.
Under the starry sky of the desert, from the very heart of evergreen forests, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, closer. Iran.
سلام. I'm a nature enthusiast and traveler. In Close Up Iran, I introduce you to the wonders and beauties of my country, Iran. Stay with me. There is nothing as good for night sleep as rose water. It helps you to get good, sound sleep and relaxes mind and body. And its aroma is fantastic. Tomorrow I'm going to experience one of my best trips ever. It's the beautiful month of May and I don't want to miss the most popular rose water festival in the world. Guess what? I'm going to take a tour to Qamsar, where the purest rose water in the world is produced. Iran Rose Water Festival is held every year in spring, usually from mid-May to the end of June, mainly hosted by the cities of Qamsar and Niyasar in Kashan, Isfahan province. Qamsar Rose Water is truly reputed in the world, and in terms of quality, it is absolutely unrivaled. Every year, in the second half of the spring, Qamsar hosts domestic and foreign tourists who travel to this city to get acquainted with how to prepare rose water and to be able to get it directly from rose water producers and other quality traditional products. In Farsi language, rose water means gulab, and the process for obtaining rose water is called gulabgiri. It is Qamsar, the city of rosewater. Here is where you experience a bit of history, a dose of nature, and a whole lot of culture. I said culture because rosewater or gulab has been used by Iranians since ancient times as medicine, food, and even perfume. Even in Persian poetry, the word gulab or rose water is used in different occasions. For example, Iranian poet Maulana says, "Come out here where the roses have opened. Let soul and world meet." Oh, for moments I was overwhelmed by the aroma of roses and got separated from this world. Okay, I need to take a little walk to reach the site of the festival. Gula or rose water is obtained from a particular kind of rose known as Mohammadi rose in Iran. Harvesting flowers seems to be the most important part of the process. Look at these copper pots. They are very heavy. People are putting them on traditional ovens made from bricks, stones, and mud. Now they are putting the petals into the pots for boiling and adding water to the pots. During the whole process, the flame should be steady and mild. After being boiled, the extracted water is kept in special bottles. Almost every 30 kilograms of rose petals plus 80 liters of water is poured into each pot that is connected to metal pipes for the steam moving through to obtain hydrosol. I'll get some bottles of this pure rose water for my family, surely. All Iranian households have a bottle of rose water in the kitchen, as it is the main ingredient to many sweets, foods, and drinks in Iranian cuisine. Let me tell you something interesting. The holy Kaaba in Mecca is washed with rose water of Qamsar. Qamsar is a patch of paradise. So seize the day and pack your suitcase to be here. Because as the Iranian poet Hafez says, hold dear all the flowers and commune. Came to be and will wither with a breeze or a gale.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
addresses A to Z. An introduction to an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, how can we feel happy and delighted? In the name of God, the most gracious, the most merciful, may his peace and blessings be upon Muhammad and his pure, immaculate Ahlul Bayt. Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. You're listening to A to Z on IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. We are going to start our program with a question. And that is, how can I smile when I do not feel happy and or delighted inside myself? I want to be active and not sad and idle. Would you please tell me how I could arrive at this aim? Very good question. To answer this question first, let your conscience be satisfied and at ease, because this is the thing that makes you smile and feel real cheerfulness. This comes from believing Allah and the following what He has revealed to His Messenger and what the infallible Imams السلام, have declared. They have declared that believing in Allah, contentment, and avoiding greediness brings man mental relief, and being satisfied with one's fate increases and solidates that relief. If you obtain this relief through these religious beliefs, problems and troubles will not deprive you of your smile and you will not worry at all. Allah the Almighty says in the Holy Quran, and be not infirm and be not grieving, and you shall have the upper hand if you are believers.
Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين.
Welcome back, dear brothers and sisters. You're listening to A to Z, IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. In the previous part, we talked about the ways of feeling happy and delighted and also feeling the cheerfulness in our life. And the main factor and the main way is believing in Allah and following the rules that He has relieved to His Messenger and what the infallible Imams والسلام, has declared in our ahadith. So, religion has declared that serving people, helping the needy, and fulfilling the rights of one's family cause the relief of one's conscience. Looking at the green nature, pondering on the stars, listening to the singing of birds, and also listening to good maxim makes man happy and delighted. When man achieves some success in one of his aims, he feels happy and cheerfulness, which affects his activities, and a smile appears on his face. Islam has encouraged all that because it is the religion of activeness, vigor, progress, production, and not of laziness, worry, burden, and grief. Inshallah, I hope everyone feel happiness and cheerfulness in his or her life. Thank you for listening to us.
IRIB English Radio, Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The sounding bell of the U.S. stock market, symbolic of a stock market that should be performing well. But these cheers are not reflective of what is going on in the U.S. economy. Instead, warning signs should be going off due to the U.S. banking sector. Trading was halted in shares of two more U.S. lenders. Regulators had to step in after PacWest and Western Alliance shares plunged. Although there was optimism in Wall Street after stocks, like in the banking sector, jumped Friday, following a good jobs report and strong Apple earnings, there were still fears and worries about the sector after the failure of four mid-sized banks since early March. Bank customers and investors feared a repeat of other bank failures in the U.S., like First Republic, SVB, and Signature. And those fears are justified. As many as 16 mid-sized banks have shed more than $57 billion in market value since last Friday. American regulators seized then-sold First Republic Bank to J.P. Morgan Chase on Monday, marking the second-largest ever U.S. bank collapse and the third major bank shutdown nationwide in the past 2 months, following the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank, or SVB, and Signature Bank.
Today, the Federal Reserve issued its long-awaited report on the cause of the Silicon Valley Bank failure. And while it put the failure squarely in the hands of management and its board for failing to oversee a safe and sound business plan, the Fed did put some heat on itself that its own bank regulators did not respond quickly enough and forcefully enough to conditions on the ground, and these conditions also are conditions that First Republic faced.
The question that is being raised once again is, are we witnessing a repeat of the U.S. financial crisis? Since 2001, more than 500 banks across the U.S. have closed. Most happened after the 2008 financial crisis. Of all the banks that closed since 2001, the largest was Washington Mutual, which closed in September 2008, during the early stages of the financial crisis. The closure of First Republic is the second largest bank closure in the U.S. and the largest since the end of the financial crisis. But this is what stands out for those that believe that there is another financial crisis in the making. About 70 banks across the U.S. have closed over the past decade. The total assets of the three banks closed this year has exceeded the total assets of the 25 banks that closed in 2008, meaning that the scale of U.S. bank closures in 2023 is the largest in years.
In this case, you had a group of banks here that did not plan well for interest rate risk. They did not plan well for big growth, explosive growth. They didn't plan for what they should be planning for, and that's a liquidity event where you have more than ordinary numbers of withdrawals, especially given their levels of uninsured deposits. That's a problem. And so, you know, the chickens have kind of come home to roost for all of these banks.
As seen here, the three banks, namely First Republic, Silicon Valley Bank, and Signature Bank, held a total of $532 billion in assets. That is more than the $526 billion, when adjusted for inflation, held by the 25 banks that collapsed in 2008 at the height of the global financial crisis. There are major factors that are affecting the health of U.S. banks. One of them are the recent Fed hikes. In March of this year, a study jointly released by economists from multiple universities in the U.S. showed that the Fed's rate hike greatly increased the vulnerability of the U.S. banking system.
Fed, just as they were stubborn and obstinate on the idea that inflation was transitory, they're being stubborn and obstinate on the idea that they need to hit 2% inflation before they let up on the tightening. And that's simply just history doesn't bear it out. And unless and until they come to that realization by studying history, you're going to see more and more of these situations.
Affected by the Federal Reserve's aggressive interest rate hikes, the value of financial assets like bonds held by many U.S. banks has shrunk sharply, and the asset value of some banks has even decreased by more than 20%. According to the study, if market confidence continues to weaken and more depositors withdraw their deposits, as many as 186 banks may become insolvent and face the risk of closure. That should be a major concern for the Fed and the man on top, the U.S. President Joe Biden. Another item of concern for the U.S. administration is the U.S. debt ceiling. As it stands, the Biden administration remains at odds with Republicans who have refused to increase the debt ceiling.
Our MAGA Republicans in Congress are threatening to undo all this progress by letting us, quote, default on the debt unless we agree to their demands. The two are totally unrelated. Whether you pay the debt or not doesn't have a damn thing to do with what your budget is, where are you going to spend money, how are you going to raise the money, what are you going to cut, they're two separate issues.
If the debt ceiling, which has reached its peak of $31.4 trillion, is not raised, that could potentially lead to a government shutdown on June 1st. The U.S. government reaction so far, in terms of an intervention, has been subdued. The Sentry says even though U.S. banks are failing, it is reported that U.S. authorities are unlikely to intervene. The reason given, regional lenders such as PacWest and Western Alliance are not seen as systemically important, and more consolidation is predicted to be ahead. The outlook, however, looks bleak. Unless the Fed rides to the rescue with cuts in interest rates, the options are amalgamation, regulation, or more banks going bust. The response of the U.S. authorities suggests little appetite for a laissez-faire approach. While the U.S. is struggling with these economic issues, it is also facing the prospects of de-dollarization, which is uncontrollable since many countries are queuing up to wean their economy off the dollar. Russia has accused Ukraine of attacking the Kremlin with drones in a failed assassination attempt to kill President Vladimir Putin, vowing retaliation for what it has called a terrorist attack. Moscow has said the two drones were used in the alleged attack on Putin's residence in the Kremlin's citadel overnight, adding that the drones were disabled by electronic defenses.
It is technically possible. Ukraine has several types of drones that can fit the profile. For example, its newly developed UJ-22 drone can actually fly the distance. It's a commercial drone that they acquired from China. It's Mugin 5 cargo drone, which can be basically purchased online and could be refitted into a military drone. That drone can fly several hundred kilometers, and it was used in previous attacks.
Kremlin statement said, "We regard these actions as a planned terrorist act and an attempt on the president's life carried out on the eve of Victory Day, the May 9 parade, at which the presence of foreign guests is also planned."
And of course, attacks of this kind, if they are in fact carried by Ukrainian military, are meant to keep the Russian military off balance by forcing them to reallocate and rededicate air defense resources to specific places like Moscow, probably at the expense of other regions, including, for example, Russian military inside Ukraine proper that has to have enough air defense and electronic warfare protection.
Separately, the Speaker of Russia's parliament demanded the use of, quote, weapons capable of stopping and destroying the Kiev terrorist regime, response to the alleged attack on Kremlin. However, Ukraine denied any involvement in the alleged drone operation. Kiev has said the attack was, quote, staged by Moscow.
The Russians may try to leverage this narrative around an assassination on Putin to then up their game with regards to pretext up their game to go after Zelensky himself. But they've been trying to do that anyway since the beginning of the war. There's plenty of reporting that indicates Russian kind of kill teams were out there trying to hunt down both Zelensky and his family. So it's mainly, I think, a rally around the flag effect that the Russians are going for.
Meanwhile, Ukraine says Russia has targeted cities in a new wave of missile strikes and shelling across the country. Officials and media outlets say multiple explosions were heard in the capital, Kiev, and elsewhere. Blasts caused by Russian shelling were also reported in the southern Zaporizhzhia region and the port city of Odessa. Kiev and some central and eastern Ukrainian regions have announced air alerts following the Russian statements accusing Ukraine of attacking the Kremlin. There are now some reports that Ukrainian forces have begun their counterattack in Bakhmut. Russian officials have said Ukraine's counteroffensive against Russia will have no benefit and will only lead to more bloodshed. The U.S. and its allies have put much hope in the offensive. However, leaked documents show Western military officials do not expect Ukraine to regain as much territory. Ukrainian forces have also been using lots of manpower and other resources fighting in Bakhmut. The intensifying crisis comes amid fresh U.S. military aid to Ukraine. The U.S. is sending another $300 million military aid package to Ukraine, including, for the first time, short-range air-launched rockets, deepening its involvement in the war in defiance of repeated warnings by Russia. The package includes Hydra-70 rockets, which are unguided projectiles fired from aircraft. It also includes artillery rounds, 155-millimeter howitzer cannons, anti-tank missiles, and mortars. The Pentagon has also sent at least 20 high-mobility artillery rocket systems, HIMARS, to Ukraine. HIMARS systems, which are made by Lockheed Martin, are intended to be a core component of Ukraine's fighting force in the future. The package brings the total amount of U.S. military aid to about $36 billion. The U.S. is still drawing funds for military assistance to Ukraine from the $45 billion aid package that Congress authorized in December.
Running against Russia, being nasty to Russia, is very popular. But I'll tell you what's not popular. More than 60% of the American people do not like all the money we're spending on Ukraine. And the American media is not reporting that, and it's also not reporting that there's demonstrations are going every weekend in Europe, particularly in Germany. There's a lot of demonstrations, like, not about the pipeline, against the war, the money that's being spent on Ukraine, and the whole notion of that war, and the whole rationale for the war. And you can almost understand why Biden wanted to keep Germany from having the option to open the pipeline.
The $45 billion is expected to be exhausted by the summer, meaning the White House might ask Congress for more funds soon. The U.S. and its Western allies have kept feeding Ukraine with massive amounts of arms since the start of the war last year. Moscow has time and again warned that military assistance will only prolong the war.
A well-known resistance actor within the Palestinian prisoners movement, Hadar Adnan, has passed away on the 86th day of his hunger strike inside an Israeli prison following two decades of arrests. Hadar spent nearly a fifth of his life behind bars, arrested 12 times by Israeli forces and subjected to over 8 years of captivity. He used hunger strikes to take power back and mobilize the world outside his prison cell in support of the Palestinian prisoners' struggle. Sustained arbitrary arrests and medical neglect led to Khadr's death. The Palestinian Human Rights Organizations Council thus viewed Khadr's killing as premeditated murder by the Israeli regime. Israeli prison services were holding Khadr in solitary confinement and refused his family visitation rights right up to his death. He survived by his wife and 9 children. In his lifetime, Hadar Adnan carried out 6 hunger strikes. His first protest in 2004 lasted 25 days and popularized hunger strikes as an accessible means of resistance within the regime's military prison system. His second hunger strike in 2012, that lasted 66 days, was joined by hundreds of prisoners and triggered an international movement for the freedom of Palestinian prisoners. In 2015, he went on his third hunger strike for 56 days against another administrative detention. In 2017, Hadar was again arrested and went on a 58-day hunger strike. His fifth 25-day-long strike was directed at his penultimate arrest in 2021. During his most recent arrest in February, Israeli forces raided his home and terrorized his family. Hadar was no stranger to civil disobedience, therefore responded by immediately going on an open hunger strike. Israeli prison services retaliated with isolation orders, renewed every 2 weeks without review. He was held under deplorable conditions and was subjected to regular abuses. When Hadar fell seriously ill in April, ISP refused to transfer him to a hospital. Hadar was found unconscious in isolation in Ramallah Prison Clinic on May 2nd. Using deliberate medical neglect, indefinite isolation, and detention extensions, the regime foresaw and facilitated Hadar's death. He was killed behind the bars, a fate shared by over 233 Palestinian political prisoners. The international community's failure to intervene amplifies past evidence that international law is just a tool for the colonizer regime of Israel, not Palestinians. It shows that the international community aids and abets the Israeli regime's crimes by its deafening silence that today rings loud after the death of Hadar Adnan. Palestinians rallied in Gaza City as shops closed during a general strike following the death of Palestinian hunger striker Hadar Adnan in Israeli custody. In his hometown near Jenin, in the occupied West Bank, Adnan's 9-year-old son, Ali, led a protest march. Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammad Shataya described the death of Adnan, who was arrested in the occupied West Bank, as a deliberate assassination.
The Palestinian cabinet holds the Israeli occupation, the prison authorities and all its agencies fully accountable for the martyrdom of Qadir Adnan. And we consider this a deliberate assassination by rejecting his request for release, neglecting him medically and keeping him in his cell despite the seriousness of his health condition.
Also, different Palestinian factions held the regime responsible for his death, saying that Israel will pay dearly for its crime.
The occupation bears full responsibility, and we will carry out our role in confronting those crimes and those assaults, in particular this crime which led to the martyrdom of Sheikh Hero Hadar Adnan.
Gaza-based Hamas resistance movement has also warned that the Israeli crime will not go unanswered. Also, the Fatah movement of President Mahmoud Abbas has called for immediate international action in support of Palestinians languishing in Israeli jails. According to Palestinian Prisoner Society, 4,900 Palestinian detainees are currently in Israeli jails, with 1,000 of them being held in administrative detention without charge. That's the highest number since 2003. People squeezed by inflation and demanding economic justice took to streets across Europe to mark May Day in an outpouring of worker discontent not seen since before the worldwide COVID-19 lockdowns. But what is May Day and why is it celebrated on May 1st? Also referred to as International Workers' Day, people across the world commemorate the contributions of workers and the labor movement on this day. Although observed as an ancient Northern Hemisphere spring festival initially, May 1st became associated with the labor movement in the late 19th century, after trade unions and socialist groups decided to designate it as a day in support of the working class people. The decision was taken in memory of Chicago's Haymarket Affair, which took place on May 4, 1886, when a violent clash broke out between the police and labor protesters. The incident happened after a bomb went off at Haymarket Square in Chicago, where the police had arrived to break a peaceful rally. Ultimately, 7 police officers were killed and 60 others were injured before the violence ended. It's estimated that 4 to 8 civilians died and 30 to 40 were wounded. Many of the protesters who were demonstrating against workers' rights violations, long work hours, poor working conditions, low wages, and child labor were arrested and served terms of life imprisonment, death sentences, and so forth. And those who died were hailed as Haymarket martyrs. The Haymarket Affair had a lasting effect on the workers' movement and helped push forward the demands for better working conditions across the world. This year's May Day events unleashed pent-up frustration after 3 years of COVID-19 restrictions. For months, Europe has seen a series of strikes as workers demand higher wages in the face of record-high inflation rates. In the 19-nation euro currency zone, the annual inflation rate was at an all-time high of 10.6% in October. It retreated slightly to 10.1% in November, but that was still the second highest monthly rate since the creation of the euro in 1999. Hundreds of thousands of people massed in cities around France to vent their anger against President Emmanuel Macron's pension reform. Protests took a violent turn as the day progressed, with protesters and security forces clashing. Interior Minister Gerald Darmanin told reporters that at least 108 police officers were wounded, with 291 detained across the country. Protesters threw projectiles at police and broke windows of business buildings, including banks and estate agents in Paris. Security forces used tear gas and water cannons in return. Trade unions had called for more than 300 rallies and vowed to continue fighting even after the changes were signed into law. Protests had started largely peacefully, although police in Paris arrested 22 people, while in Lyon, police used tear gas to disperse crowds after bank windows were smashed. Sophie Binet, leader of the CGT union, said Macron's pension reform had left her isolated.
You just have to look at the procession behind. You can see that today is a historic May Day. There hasn't been such an important May Day in France since 1936, so we can't talk about running out of steam. We can't talk about decay. We can see that this day of mobilization is a stinging denial of all the bets made by the government and of the choice that the government was thinking of making to force us to turn the page.
Protesters mobilized against President Emmanuel Macron's recent move to raise the retirement age from 62 to 64. Organizers see pension reform as a threat to hard-fought worker rights, while Macron argues it's economically necessary as the population ages.
اقرأ باسم ربك الذي خلق.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. يا أيها المزمل قم الليل إلا قليلا نصفه
أو انقص منه قليلا أو زد عليه ورتل القرآن ترتيلا.
قد دعوتك ربي بقرآنك جنبني حراني.
Let's recite the Quran.
ناجيتك أرجو غفرانك يا من ينجينا إحسانك ودعوتك ربي بقرآنك.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad wa ajjil farajahum. Assalamu alaikum, brothers and sisters, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to Let's Recite the Quran Kareem, a series of Quranic sessions and practical tajweed rules, step by step, verse by verse. Inshallah, we're here with you. And I really welcome you all. Thanks for joining IRIB English Radio. Fawad Haider, Salam, Hassan, Hussein, and Ali Nasir, welcome, brothers. Is everyone fine?
Alhamdulillah.
So, inshallah, let's go and start our class. Inshallah, today we'll talk about Ayah 94.